Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Lillian Nakagawa, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's program, a perfect brew, Blue Bottle Coffee and Japan's Culture by James Freeman. To introduce Mr. Freeman, I would like to introduce Mr. Akira Ichioka, Director Consul of the Consulate General of Japan in San Francisco, who will introduce Mr. Freeman. Mr. Ichioka?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Akira Ichioka. I'm a consul for public relations and cultural affairs at Japanese Consulate in San Francisco. And thank you for joining us for the first installment of our three Japanese food series. First of all, I would like to thank the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco, the California, for partnering with us as we take a closer look at the some of the most exciting innovators in the local food scenes and their connection to Japan. And today, I'm sure everybody knows him already, but I'm proud to introduce James Freeman, founder of a Blue Bottle Coffee, one of the leaders in what has been dubbed the local food scene and the third wave of coffee. Now with stores in the Bay Area, New York and LA and also Japan, Blue Bottle is creating a new standards in what we expect from our coffee shops. So I'm personally very excited to have this opportunity to have him here today. So let's listen as Mr. Freeman explains what inspiration he has drawn from Japan as he continues to create and shape his brand and products. So please welcome Mr. Freeman.
Thank you for coming today. My name's James. I founded Blue Bottle Coffee in 2002. And tonight, what I thought we'd go over, I'm going to talk a little bit about my life before I started Blue Bottle, because it's probably relevant. Talk a little bit about the history of Blue Bottle, talk about how we started in Japan and what's going on in Japan, a little bit about the future, and there will be slides. They will be tangentially related to the content. Perhaps there will be times when the content and the slides merge and it makes sense to see what I'm talking about, but I thought that would be interesting to show some pictures. And then there'll be questions and answers, maybe a one-to-one correspondence between questions and answers, and then I thought we'd go upstairs, maybe have a glass of wine, then we're done. I hope you've enjoyed the coffee and the treats that the RTD team has provided. Thank you very much. I don't know if you're still there, thank you very much. Appreciate coming. Those are two products that we're very proud of. The can and the black coffee just came out. The Nola carton has been out for a couple of years. So I'm here talking about Blue Bottle Coffee. I started the thing about 14 years ago, but I'm kind of an emanation of Blue Bottle Coffee now. I'm really speaking for about 650 people at Blue Bottle Coffee. It's primarily people that make stuff. It's primarily baristas, people who travel the world, buy green coffee, QC people, quality control, that is, roasters, people that work in the kitchen, porters, shop managers. Blue Bottle Coffee is also people that run stuff. Blue Bottle Coffee is executives in finance and digital and communications and design. So there's a lot of us at Blue Bottle Coffee. They're going to, this time next year, there might be 1,000 of us or more. So I'm speaking for them as well as just for me. I'm also speaking, this is a coffee. This is the Embu Kathanga Riri coffee from Kenya. Blue Bottle Coffee is also, there's about 320 farmers that work for this co-op. Our green buyer, Charlie, went there and cupped this coffee, and he loved it, and he loved what they were doing with their farms. And he wants to work with them every year if he can, and he wants the coffee to get better and better. And they do, too, because we'll pay them more and more. So I'm also speaking for them, too, because that's Blue Bottle Coffee. And we're all in service to our product. We're all in service to this thing that we roast and serve. We're in service to the people who grow it, the people who ship our product, the people who make the coffee bags, the people who make those cups, those cans, those cartons, people who test it. And ultimately, we're in service to the guests who come into our shops. We have 26 of them. Now, this time next year, we might have 40. A couple of years from now, who knows? Maybe we'll just have 3. Maybe there'll be 75. I'm not sure. Oh, is the microphone not working? Okay. Sorry. I'm a mumbler sometimes. How's that? Is that better? Thumbs up? Great. Well, thank you, Lunya. Great. So there we are. So we're all in service to our guests. Tonight I'm in service to you, speaking on behalf of all of us, Blue Bottle Coffee. In case it's interesting, I thought I'd tell you a bit about what I used to do. I was a classical musician before I started Blue Bottle Coffee. People have this idea of what it means to be a musician. They think we put on our tuxes and go to the concert hall and play a concert and then we leave. But really what classical musicians do is do the same thing over and over again, alone in a room, thousands of times, trying to get a little tiny bit better at it. To be a little bit better at it at the end of the day than at the beginning. We repeat to perfect. And then we're confronted with our own inadequacies on a regular basis. And it sounds glamorous, I know. I'll keep going. But it was a hard life for me. I was good enough to get the jobs that I didn't want and not quite good enough to get the jobs that I really did. And so it was a frustrating life because classical musicians are in service to Mozart. They're in service to Beethoven. They're in service to Bach and Messiaen, the great, profound leaders of art in the Western canon. And if you make a mistake, if you disappoint, it's one thing to make an espresso, not have it come out quite right, because what do you do? What are your options? You make it again, and it's fine. But if you make a mistake when you're playing Mozart, then you've just like disappointed, you've failed this genius. So that was hard on me. And I was a farmer's market shopper, so I was looking for a way to escape this cycle I was in with my music, with clarinet playing. I had this kind of dysmorphia. It's a Pablo Picasso quote that I think is apropos. I knew what I didn't want to do, and that was play the clarinet. I loved coffee, and I had a geeky little hobby of roasting it at home. And this idea of coffee as fresh food was very interesting to me, literally in San Francisco at the time when I was career transitioning. You couldn't buy a bag of coffee with a roast date on it, and that seemed wrong. It seemed that shouldn't have to be. Because as a geeky little hobbyist of roasting coffee at home, I knew that when the coffee was roasted made a difference. It, in fact, made a great difference. It made a huge difference. It made all the difference. And as a farmer's market shopper, I knew that model of commerce, right? You make a thing, you go to the market, people give you money, you give them that thing you made, and you go home, and then you make that thing again, right? How hard could it be? This whole business thing. It's not like Messiaen. So that was my idea. I was stuck. I was so disappointed that I wasn't born Ralph McLean or Harold Wright, the two titans, the two people that I really wanted to sound like. I wasn't really concerned about sounding like me, unfortunately. That's where this dysmorphia headed. But what I could do is I had the capacity to work. I had the capacity to repeat, to perfect. I had the capacity to imagine sensory outcomes, and I had the capacity for yearning. And all of those things actually prepared me quite well for this last 14 years, this career in coffee. Much happier as a coffee roaster, actually. So what did I do? I went to the farmers markets. That's how I started. This picture is not a crime scene. It's my first roastery. It's a little potting shed behind the restaurant Doña Tomás in Temescal and 51st and Telegraph. It was 186 square feet. So maybe imagine a slice of this room that's bounded by the wall on my right and the chairs on my left. And that was the size of my roastery. The ceiling was about the size of those sconces. Is that a sconce? Is it a sconce if it hangs from the ceiling? Anyway. So that was it. It was very cheap to start, and it let me start experimenting. It let me start working on my product. I was really interested in this thing, this fresh coffee, and I could understand the model of commerce represented by the farmers markets, and so I did it. I didn't know that having two credit cards with a limit of $10,000 each wasn't enough to start a business, so that's how I started. And that's a picture at the farmers market. So, you know, all I was interested in was the product, this primary experience of tasting the coffee, drinking the coffee, and making the coffee better and better every time I would roast a batch, every time I would make an espresso, every time I would make a pour over. And that product first orientation has served us actually very well. It's easy to get bound up in market research, to get lost by hiring consultants, and to get away from this primary experience of what does the coffee taste like? What is it like to walk into a shop, order coffee, and drink it? What does that feel like? And that's really all I thought about. That's all I cared about. And I wasn't too concerned. Being a musician, I wasn't too concerned about efficiency. I wasn't too concerned about pragmatism. Obviously, if you spend most of your day, every day between age 12 and age 34, doing something that the world at large is not exactly clamoring for, it untethers you from the practicalities of commerce. And so sometimes I'm finding out it's good to be untethered from the practicalities of commerce. So there we are. That was a farmer's market. And then I opened, in 2005, I opened this little kiosk in Hayes Valley on a pea-smelling alleyway. It was a dead-end alleyway at the time. It was a six-drink menu, no sizes, no flavors. We made every drink to order. First PID espresso machine in California. PID, stands for proportional integrative derivative. It's a very precise way of measuring temperature. It's rather standard on espresso machines now, but at the time, I had to hire this kind of crazy person that I met at the farmer's market to put it in. He said he wasn't going to charge me, and then he charged me so much. And I said, why did you charge me so much? And then he said, well, I was just waiting to see if you'd notice, and if you paid me, that was great, but you don't have to pay me. Those are the things you learn. So that was the kiosk, and I often wonder what went right. It's kind of nice to look back. It's easy to look back and say what went wrong, but it's kind of nice to look back and say what went right. Because if I had done adequate market research, I would have asked, potential customers, so do you want coffee that's roasted lighter than you say your preferences are? Do you want smaller portions? Do you want fewer options? Do you want to wait a little bit longer? Do you want to have fewer choices? And I would have heard no. But because I put it in this context of a type of coffee experience that people hadn't primarily been exposed to, it was a garage in an alleyway, I think that stripped people of their expectations, and I was able to get at something that was more primary, this experience of the product, that people didn't have a lot of associations with dead-end alley coffee. So they came in with a little more of an open mind, and it's still there on Linden Street. Parenthetically, my wife and I named our daughter Linden. And it's still there, and it's still busy, and it's still very minimal, just a few options, but some nice ones. So how did this whole Japanese influence start? And that started at Mint Plaza in 2008. January 23rd, 2008, we opened on Mint Plaza. And I was very infatuated with Japanese coffee equipment, Japanese coffee style, primarily because of one person. His name's Jay Igami. And he works for UCC Coffee Company, which is a big coffee company. But he's the only West Coast employee of UCC Coffee. And he came by my farmer's market stand around 2006. We became friends, and he started telling me about how they make coffee in Japan. And how they make coffee in Japan kind of blew my mind, because they had these kettles and they had this delicate swan neck that let them pour very slowly and precisely. They measured the water, they measured the coffee, and they expressed the difference in those two as a ratio. And I remember very clearly there was this moment of rejection, because my life was about to get very, very hard. Because that's a very hard way to make coffee, and I didn't want it to get harder. It seemed hard enough. But I tried it. We got some kettles. He imported the first pouring kettles from Japan for us at Blue Bottle, and we started playing around with these different ratios, these different techniques, and it tasted so much better. It was very exciting. Exciting for me, exciting for all of us at Blue Bottle. And he also showed me these beautiful machines, siphon coffee machines, OG slow drippers, and I became very, very interested in all the techniques and equipment of Japanese coffee traditions through my friend Jay Gami. And when I found this building in Mint Plaza, it's near Fifth and Mission, the verticality, it's a beautiful, elegant space built in 1922, the verticality of the space made me think that that was going to be a perfect place to put a siphon bar, very sculptural, very vertical. We'll talk about Sartre later. The verticality seemed to match, and that's when it really hit me that I wasn't trying to reproduce Japanese coffee, but I was trying to use these techniques, these other means, to express my own individuality through these beautiful machines and beautiful techniques. And then we went to Japan. My wife and I went for the first time together in 2008, shortly after Mint Plaza had opened. And I think one day we went to 9 kisaten, and one day, is that right? Could be. This idea of the kisaten, I don't know if everybody's heard of it. These are very kind of fusty, old-fashioned, not hip, not particularly popular coffee houses of Japan. However, what they do there is stunning in their sense of meticulous attention to detail, stunning in their execution of their desires. There's this great word called kodowari, which is a space becoming the imprint of the master of the space. So everything about this space, these beautiful, perfect little bubbles, had the kodowari of the creator. And we went to so many, and I remember being struck, that's probably my phone, sorry, being struck at a place called Hatto, sitting in a long bar made out of one tree, I think, and watching this gentleman pour water from a kettle. It sounds prosaic. How could that be beautiful? My wife and I and Jay Gami were sitting waiting for our coffee, and he was pouring water out, and the droplets were right on top of each other. It was this little cascade of droplets, a pearl necklace. It looked like a little pearl necklace that he was weaving around the coffee. Maybe 5 minutes, maybe 5 hours, I don't know. It took a long time to make that coffee, but it was so perfect. His technique was so perfect. It was so beautiful. I remember being stunned at that moment and overwhelmed, because in 2008, when we opened Mint Plaza, you know, we'd been in the food section of the New York Times. I thought we were pretty good. I thought we were, kind of a big deal. And then you get to the mountaintop, and what do you see is more mountains. And being at that bar, that long bar, watching him pour, I realized there was so much more to learn, and he was so much better at coffee than I was, and I could either be despondent about it or I could try to get better too. And so that's what I did. And one of the things I realized about the kisaten is it's a way to live, it's a way to approach your life. If you can spend so much time and effort and dedication learning how to pour water, if you can warm up a saucer as well as a cup before you serve it, then that's not just about coffee, that's about how to live. Thank you, Jean-Paul. That's Jay Gummy helping me with the first siphon. That's the gentleman and his colleague at Hatto pouring. It's like when they're pouring, nothing else exists. There's a great moment. When you walk into Hatto, other places too, you order, or you try to order, because the menu's in Japanese, and then whoever takes your order sort of steps back and looks at this wall of cups behind, and it looks back. It's like, pauses. It's a very somber pause. And he's trying to figure out, for this moment, for this person, for this coffee order, what is the best cup to choose. All of those cups, you might notice, they don't match. So he's trying to figure out what is the best cup to choose for this order. And that's how it starts. The rest of the experience is managed just as meticulously, whether they're frosting a cake or making a croque monsieur or thanking you for waiting or pouring your coffee. It's all at the same exalted level. That's Daibo-san. He had a kiseten called Daibo Coffee. That's in his house. I was able to procure an invitation to his house and he made his coffee. But that same focus. His neck is, he had his kiseten for 37 years. His neck is sort of perpetually in a 90 degree angle because of that intense dedication to his pour. That's at Cafe Lambre. That's Taguchi-san at Cafe Baja and his lead roaster. So then I opened, then I got back and it really was more deep diving, not so much because I wanted to make coffee just like that. I didn't want to have spaces just like that. But I wanted to capture that essence of Kodawari. I wanted to make a space feel personal, make a coffee feel personal to what I wanted, not what Daibo-san wanted or Taguchi-san wanted. And that's kind of been the journey with every cafe, is trying to clear out obstacles towards that path. So there's our OG slow drippers, our siphon bar. I don't know. That's perfect toast. That's not our perfect toast. Somebody else's perfect toast. And interestingly enough, so to skip forward a little bit, we opened in Tokyo in 2015. There's a lot that went on before that, a lot of negotiations that went nowhere, a lot of closed doors, many closed doors. But what was interesting to me and why this picture might be here is that we brought siphon coffee back to Tokyo, and I was wondering why, you know, I was talking to the team, and there's all this interest. Yeah, we should serve siphon coffee in our cafe in Aoyama. And it actually, I didn't think it was necessary. I thought there were plenty of places to get siphon coffee in Tokyo. Why would we want to add to that? But actually, it was quite interesting because the younger generation, the type of people that tend to come to coffee shops like mine, had no idea of this kiseten connection in their own culture, and that we were helping to show them that there was this tremendously important cultural patrimony that they had in their own backyards, and that what we thought and believed was some way derived from that cultural patrimony, that to experience it from us is interesting, but to get it more primary is also interesting. And so the siphon is quite popular in Aoyama. Our style, which is very different than many styles of siphon coffee in Tokyo, but just that our ability to reflect and refract this indigenous tradition back to people in Tokyo has been one of the most pleasant surprises about all of this. I remember talking to Daibo-san, and he mentioned that there's been quite a bit of Japanese press about Blue Bottle before we launched and especially during the launch. And what he said was whenever I would be quoted in a magazine article talking about my favorite kiseten, he would notice his business got more customers and that many of the customers tended to be younger than the ones he was used to serving. And I was so humbled by that I could just, my appreciation for this very old-fashioned tradition could help guide a newer group of customers to his shops. It made me very happy to hear that. So there was a lot going on before we opened in Tokyo, from Sartre to Mike Tyson. It was my dream. You know, I knew that the standards of retail execution were very high in Tokyo. I had been inspired them for many years. And it was my dream to open, just because it's good to have a reason to go to Tokyo a lot. But also, if we can succeed and execute for the toughest retail consumers in the world, which is to say the Japanese, then that means we proved something, that we can succeed anywhere, perhaps. And that was the thesis that I wanted to test. And it took many years. There were a lot of negotiations about partnerships, joint ventures, about licenses that went nowhere, that were frustrating, that gave me this uneasy feeling that I would not be in control of the experience and the coffee when or whether I signed a deal with these people. So we decided, after many closed doors, we decided to do it ourselves, to not go into Tokyo as a joint venture, not go in as a license, but to have it be wholly and 100% financed by Blue Bottle Coffee US, which is a very unusual way of going into business in Japan, because people talk about the Japanese market all the time. They say, some of these people I talk to, Japanese market, the coffee is too light, so we'll have to roast it darker. It's like, those cookies are too big, or too this, too that. And I'm kind of used to having a fairly casual contempt for market research, and I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to hear about what Starbucks did that was different. I just wanted to do what we did. I wanted to be our best selves in Tokyo. And that's what happened. We were fortunate, and we raised a lot of money, and we had it to spend, and we kind of made a bet. We found some real estate that was interesting but also unusual because it wasn't in one of the central business districts. And we opened a roastery. We didn't ship coffee. We took the time and the effort and expense of opening a roastery and roasted the coffee there. We opened a pastry kitchen, and we baked the cookies there. We had our offices. We had our training. We had our cupping room. Everything just like it was in Oakland, as much as we could possibly make it. So that's how we opened in 2015, after many fits and starts, after many closed doors. We thought that we would just do it ourselves. And I'm very happy we did, because due to a number of reasons, sometimes I look back to our Tokyo launch, and I wonder what went right with that. And there were a few things. I think the press we got over the years was helpful, because it let people know that not only were we a Western coffee company, which was very interesting to people on its own, but that I had a lot of affection, genuine affection and affinity for the coffee traditions of Japan. I think that helped. I think our real estate choice was kind of interesting to people. It's a little bit of a, I don't want to say backwater, but it's a sleepier part of Tokyo, maybe 12 stops away on the Hanzabon line from Shibuya, so it's not exactly central. It's a very peaceful neighborhood, Kiyosumi Shirakawa. There's a lot of like sumu skulls, low density, small factories, a lot of housing, and that caused people to think it was a strange, perhaps wonderful thing that we were doing, at least a curiosity. So opening there was very interesting to people. Working with our own standards and not having any of our standards imposed from the outside was very helpful. And then just kind of getting lucky, hiring the right people at the right time, having a really, really strong leader of Japan who could understand the United States Blue Bottle, but also had a beautiful way of translating certain things about spaces. Having strong leadership was really helpful. And then sending people out from the United States to live. We have the two Andrews. They moved. Our head QC moved. So they are in Japan full-time working for us. And then just spending a lot on Japan Airlines and having a lot of people go back and forth. That really helped too, because it feels there's people in Tokyo are very astute, as consumers are very astute and very sensitive. They can feel something that seems premeditated, and like a license or a concept that isn't backed up with a lot of heart. But if they sense a heart and a sincerity behind it, then they're much more likely to continue to go. So we had a great launch. There's a lot of lines. Krispy Kreme opens, and there's four-hour lines for a few weeks. So we had a lot of lines, but it's still busy. That's the first morning we opened in our roastery. Yeah, no pressure. And that's the building. It's a great building, very luminous. The education goes both ways. Working on spaces in Tokyo has been an inspiration for me because it's felt like my most natural proclivities are encouraged in Tokyo in terms of spareness, in terms of empty shelves, in terms of light and space, just getting rid of stuff, removing barriers. That's been very inspiring to me. And so the lessons go both ways. We're seeing more of the Japanese architectural influence in our shops here, more of the Japanese hospitality, hopefully, in our shops here. And then in Tokyo, they're seeing this Oakland spirit. We have, in all of our regions, first of all, Hetch Hetchy water, Bay Area water, is very delicious, and it has a nice mineral content that makes brewing coffee with it just out of the tap. Quite delicious. And so in Tokyo, we treat the water, we balance the mineral content such that it resembles Hetch Hetchy water very strongly. So I like this image of turning on a tap in Tokyo and Oakland water is coming out. And that image carries through Oakland water, Oakland coffee. We roast on similar machines. It's the same QC protocols, same coffee. We cup every region's coffee together once a month in every region, so everybody has a chance to taste it and to try to calibrate with each other. So the more I think about what went right, the more it's about that, this authentic and sincere expression of who we are, but also an authentic and sincere expression of our appreciation for Japanese coffee culture and the culture at large and the certain things that stand behind it. More roastery pictures. Oh, that's our shop in Aoyama. And so, you know, we're in Oakland, we're in New York, we're in Tokyo, and there's a tremendous pressure to try to bend certain things to not have the same standards of coffee quality or cleanliness or drink prep. And that's the struggle that we have to be on without being formulaic, but to be rigorous. If something is right in Oakland, why wouldn't it be right in Tokyo? Why wouldn't it be right in New York City? Why wouldn't it be right in Los Angeles? And that's our project. My struggle and our team's struggle is to create every space we do with this increasing sense of improvement, this increasing sense of removing barriers from our guests' primary enjoyment of this thing and the personal interactions that go on with this thing. So I like these two slides in proximity. It's a really delicious looking espresso. I won't tell you who made it. That's what I want people to see when they walk into our shops. It's Kathleen. And then that's a beautiful little thought that I think is very illustrative of the process I go through. I've never made a business plan, and hopefully I never will. Now we have plenty of people who can do those things. But I do like to dream a little bit about what I think is a better way to do things. I like to dream about the experiences that I might have and enjoy and other people might enjoy. And this idea of doors closing and then doors opening has been very powerful for me. That's how it felt in Tokyo, like after all these dead ends, after all these bad negotiations, after all this frustration, to have such a beautiful opening in Tokyo and have a good head of steam behind us, I thought was so nice. It's a beautiful sentiment that I think about quite often. Anyway, thank you very much. Oh, I should read it. Okay. Right, because this might be on the radio. Okay, thank you. Caitlin. And why didn't any else of you say that? But sometimes illumination comes to the rescue at the very moment when all seems lost. We have knocked on every door and they open on nothing until at last we stumble unconsciously against the only one through which we can enter the kingdom we have sought in vain for 100 years, and it opens. Thank you, sweetheart. All right, this concludes this portion of our presentation, and now I'm hoping somebody has questions.
Our thanks to our speaker, Mr. James Freeman, for his very interesting and heartfelt talk about Blue Bottle Coffee and opening in Japan. Thank you. And now we're open for questions. If you have a question, Cynthia here has the microphone, so just wave her down, and she will bring the microphone to you.
Thank you very much. My question is pretty brief. I just had one request, which was, could you show the Aoyama shop again? I think you went past that good. Photo. And my actual question is, how many locations, retail locations, do you now have in Japan? Thank you.
In Japan, just 3. The roastery has a coffee bar, Kiyosumi Shirakawa. We have in Aoyama, and then we just opened a few months ago during Cherry Blossom, which was so nice, in Shinjuku, the new train station, Lumine 3. And then we have plans to open in Roppongi in July, and that should be a beautiful store. And then there's 2 others that I have promised not to talk about, but could happen in this year as well. So we could be at 6 shops. All 6 of them I'm very excited about. I think they could be nice shops.
Thank you for the talk. It was really inspiring. So I went to Japan last year, and I visited this tiny little cafe called Amato Santo Cafe.
That place
and then
kills
they shut.
Me.
I know, yeah. They shut down already.
The building had to be torn down.
Yeah, that's why they shut down. Yeah. But the experience inside of that cafe just totally changed my mind towards craft coffee, and I came back and I become a coffee snob.
Nice.
So I guess my question is that I actually go to Blue Bottle almost every day, and probably I have done so much work because of drinking Blue Bottle.
Oh, that's nice. Thank
and so I see that there's a like cafes or like Starbucks, where oftentimes, not all of them, but oftentimes, like the barista, they don't really care. They just throw the coffee to you. And then some other craft coffee powerhouses in the city where they do care about their coffee. But then the experience you're there, you feel like, you know, you don't feel that same kind of customer service you would get at Blue Bottle. Where when I was in Japan, I realized that customer service, the experience they provide you, it's way beyond just the drink itself. So could you sort of describe more as Blue Bottle expands more and more locations and everywhere, especially in the city. How do you keep that culture still there for, you know, superb customer service? And
I would love to talk about that. Thank you for bringing that up. First of all, Amato Santo Coffee, I think it's the most inspiring and perfect place I've ever been to for drinking coffee. It was in this beautiful, elegant neighborhood near Aoyama, and an old house, maybe, I don't know, from the 20s, and it was just, and there was a little garden you go through, and everything there, like, the idea was the cube. That was the central design thesis of the cube. Even their little cannelés were cubic. And I love that place so much. You know, that's kind of one of the great things about Tokyo is things can happen there, but also things go away. And they tore that house down, and now it's a vacant lot. And Hotel Okura, I mean, it's the same thing. That does happen in Japan. But, you know, we'll always have it in our hearts. They have a beautiful space. It's not quite as magical. Toronomon Coffee, they call it. And I heard they just opened in Hong Kong, Amato Santo Coffee. I have seen pictures. It looks quite beautiful. Obviously not the same. But talking about keeping standards of hospitality, I think, is impossible. So you have to think of continually investing so that you're improving standards of hospitality. And that has to be our goal. So we're investing very much on what you can't see, and that's people in our people operations department who are screening all these different, not just baristas who've worked other places, but people who've worked in hotels, people who have driven Ubers, people who have taken time away from the job market, trying to get the right people. If you start with the right people, coffee's the easy part. You know, it takes, we have a great training department, so they go through training and then they get their experience and then they go to work. So that, I think you've seized on something that's absolutely critical and primary, and that is, how does it feel to get this coffee? Sometimes it doesn't matter how delicious it is if you kind of feel crappy about your experience. So that I think about quite often, maybe even every day, is how do we create this experience of joy and appreciation for a guest who comes in, that we're taking care of their needs, which are substantial. Sometimes people come into our shops and they haven't had coffee that day. You know, and that's a big responsibility. That's a grave responsibility. One of the baristas who I admire so much, who worked in Tokyo, and she's based in Oakland and she worked in Tokyo and then came back. She, I think, was so succinct. She said, in the United States, too often people are focused on making good coffee, and in Japan, they're focused on serving good coffee. And that concept of service, once again, I think is very critical to our success and the enjoyment of our guests. Any more questions?
It's amazing to see how much Blue Bottle's grown.
Isn't it?
Yeah. when you first started at the farmer's market, what was your first like goal for success?
Pay my bills. That was it. You know, I want to make something delicious. I wanted to be proud of something. And I really needed it to pay my bills because I did not want to go back to playing the clarinet. So it was. I didn't mean to cut you off, but it was very simple. I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a 5-year or 50-year plan. I just wanted to work on my product, get better at it, and have enough people buy it and enjoy it so that I could pay my bills, which were very, very small back then.
Thank you.
Hi, with apologies to those who have been with you since the beginning. Can you tell us, I'm a new relocatee.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Welcome.
So where does the name come from, and can you tell us a little bit about the concept that...
Sure, yeah. No, it's great. I assume too much sometimes. It's named after Central Europe's first coffee house, Blau Flaschen. And there was a story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or historical, but there's this great story. It doesn't matter, really, because it's a great story about the Turks sweeping across Central Europe in the 1680s, and they stopped at Vienna, and there was a siege, and they had encircled Vienna. And there was a Pole, his name was Kolschitsky, who had spent time in Arabia, spoke the language, and then supposedly he disguised himself as a Turk and crept through the enemy lines, warned the Polish cavalry. They came through and swept the Turks out of Vienna, and they left coffee. And what was thought to be camel feed, however, this gentleman Kolschitsky knew better, it was coffee, and he asked as his reward if he could have this coffee, and he started Central Europe's first coffee house. Parenthetically, that's how the croissant came to be, because the crescent flag, it was the victorious bakers of Vienna that made a little roll in the shape of the crescent so they could symbolically devour their enemies after that siege. And then we haven't heard from the lawyers in Vienna yet, so that's good. Our idea, you know, I just couldn't think, I like that story, I couldn't think of a better name at the time, so that's stuck, and it turned out being fine because the logo is, if I could find it, the logo is a blue bottle. The name of the company is Blue Bottle, and that's actually a very rare and precious thing. You see that with Apple, name of the company, and then logo is an apple. You see it with square. But there aren't very many companies who actually have that. And I think it's helped us just in terms of recognition. And what we do is we serve coffee. We serve tasty things that go along with coffee, but coffee is primary. And we try to serve the most delicious coffee we can in a very fresh, like freshness, like in terms of when it was roasted or when it was harvested. And we try to cut no corners in terms of the experience that people have around our coffee. So I hope you'll join us. Yes.
Hi, James. It's fantastic. I wanted to congratulate you on such a incredible idea, and your passion is fantastic, and it's so inspiring.
Thank you.
And
it's
I'm just so glad that a coffee shop has the serviced end. Really, that's what they're focusing on. That's what you're focusing on. I think it's such an important thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
But my question in regards to your first shop in Hayes Valley, why did you come to the decision to kind of simplify and just serve, you know, one size, one coffee, something just so simple where it seems like that would be against customer service, where you're providing less, I don't want to say less of a product because it's a beautiful product and it tastes great, but less options to a customer?
Oh, right. I think about that a lot, because what people say they want and what they actually want are oftentimes two very different things. You know, people might say, oh, I want this much coffee, or I want hazelnut flavor, or, people say that they want certain things. And at Starbucks, obviously, there are many permutations of drinks that people can obtain, and that, you know, that's one way of acknowledging their humanity is, you know, with so many permutations, like how many pumps you get and how many of this and that, that's one way of acknowledging somebody's uniqueness, somebody's humanity. But I think what is deeper and what resonates even more deeply with somebody is this idea, oh, they're making it the best way they know how, the most perfect way they can. And that's a way of recognizing somebody's humanity that I think resonates even deeper. It's like, well, maybe 20 ounces is too much. Maybe 20 ounces is not as perfect as 12 ounces. And I didn't realize that, but I'm happy somebody gave me 12 ounces instead of 20 ounces. So we can't please everybody. Some people want what they want, and however hard we work, we won't be able to cross that bridge with them. But I think some people really see that we're working so hard on this one thing that we think they're really going to love, that that's enough for them. And the fact that it's not available in small, medium, and large, or through an app that you order ahead so it sits for 10 minutes, you know, that I think people forgive us that.
Yes.
Yes. Right, I went there briefly as a musician in when I was 19, and then there was a big gap, and then I went in 2008, yes.
Where did your inspiration for having customer service come from? Was that from just you wanting to create something so perfect?
It's really evolved. When I first started, I was so concentrated on the product that I didn't realize that an experience of our product was a product in itself. So I feel like as I've gone to Japan more especially and seen hospitality executed at this rarefied level, and also, as you know, I'm just getting older and I don't have time for some barista to be shitty to me. You know, it's like I just don't. And I think there's a lot of people that feel that way too. It's a more competitive environment, and there's other places. You know, when we started, there were very few people that were working very hard on coffee to make something delicious. I used to say on the island of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. But now there's more options, and if we alienate people, it doesn't matter how great our coffee is. So I think just sort of having that experience of being in Japan, being older, being human for longer, knowing that I like it when people feel really great when they leave a shop. You know, that's not just good business. It's powerful. It's connecting with somebody. So all of those things have made it seem more and more obvious that in addition to investing in this product, that our product is the way people feel about us, and we need to invest very hard in that too. Yes.
Well, I appreciate how much you put into the customer service and how you make your coffee as best as you possibly can. And my question is how do you take that experience and put it into a can and a carton?
I think that's a great viewpoint, because it is an experience. Even when you get it in a can, you know, there's some emanation of Blue Bottle coffee that needs to be in there, and it needs to feel like it's right and it's authentic. And the hospitality that we, you know, that's the question. How do you display hospitality in a can on a Whole Foods shelf, right? And so the hospitality that we have to exhibit is all the QC work that happened in order to, when you pop open that can and you pour it in a cup, you think, man, is this even better than when I had it at that shop? You know, that making it so pure, it's, you know, I really admire the profession of barista, and I respect so many of our staff and their professionalism. And I don't, you know, we sell that in our shops, and I don't want them to not be proud of something that we sell in our shops. And so I think about them. It's like, are they going to be really psyched that we have this? Are they going to think it's delicious and better than anything else they can have? If, you know, I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want to disappoint our guests. So having a product that's pure, that's organically certified, that we know is just as good as what's in our shops, that's a form of hospitality, all the QC, all the development, because it's kind of expensive and the portion sizes are sort of small, and we have to do that because if we wanted to cheap out on it, it wouldn't taste as good, you know, and nobody wants that. So I think that's a great question. And I do like, you know, I was a performer. I like having a stage, and I do want to get our stuff out there to people. I made the decision a year or so ago to close off our wholesale business. And that's a lot of coffee companies are 70, 80% of their revenue is wholesale. So we don't do that anymore. So we're focusing on this as a way to have emanations beyond our shops, beyond the regions we do business in.
I wanted to ask about continuing the discussion on quality. Mm. Do you think Americans in general are becoming more interested and appreciate quality over quantity? Or is this unique in the Bay Area, New York, Tokyo?
I don't think so. You know, if you just think of, like, what is the average olive oil that is in somebody's cupboard in the United States now compared to 10 years ago, mm-hmm. it's better. Because mm-hmm. you know, once they've had something that's a little bit better, most people want that. They don't want that thing that's not as good. So, you know, there are demographic, we go to the cities where I like to go to, and that's Los Angeles and New York and Tokyo and San Francisco. And you know, so it's a very limited view of the United States. But there's great shops there that are doing well. We have former employees that are in Portland, Maine, and they're doing great. In Columbus, mm-hmm. Ohio, we have a couple that used to work for us and moved out. I have a place called Fox in the Snow, and they're doing great. So I think, you know, good coffee is very democratic. You know, maybe it costs a dollar more than some other place, but people don't mind paying a little more if something's really good, something's so primary.
Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on the differences in taste between the customers you have in Tokyo and the ones you have in the United States? Do they, in one or the other locations, do they favor certain varieties of coffee? Do they prefer blends? Do they like maybe lattes more or espresso more?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And there is, in our Japanese shops, our Tokyo shops, people order brewed coffee a lot more than espresso drinks. In San Francisco, it's much more like milky espresso drinks, cappuccino, latte, mocha. Those are very, very popular drinks. In Tokyo, it's brewed coffee. Bless their heart. They hardly add cream or sugar to it as well. So there's a lot of black coffee drunk in our shops, and we have these big lineups of drippers, kettles, and it's very arduous for execution. But that's the biggest difference, I would say. They like sweets a lot. The pound cake, I would say, is even more popular in Tokyo than here. Coffee and cake in Tokyo, it's like you walk around at 2 o'clock and all the patisseries are full. It's a wonderful place if you like touring symphony orchestras and coffee and cake.
I went to Tulane Graduate School in New Orleans about 20 years ago.
Oh,
and
nice.
PJ's coffee shop, their iced coffee, I loved it. And I couldn't get it anywhere else after I left New Orleans. So I was super excited when I came across Blue Bottle and the New Orleans style.
Yeah.
Yes, so it was lovely. But my question related to something you had mentioned earlier about when you were in Japan, you had an individual helping you translate. And it was. I was wondering what he helped you with architecturally when you were doing your shop or other things.
It was a she. It is a she.
Sorry.
That's all right, Saki-san. She just has a great way of looking at a store and seeing similar things that I do. I like to have not very many things on a shelf. I like to have not decorations. I like to strip things away. My wife is very inspiring in that regard. I call her a bulimic of the home. She's getting rid of, maybe I shouldn't have said that. She's like always getting rid of things, and that sense of spareness I find deeply comforting. And our head of Japan, Saki, she doesn't have a she's not trained in design, she's not trained in project management, but she's just got this intuitive sense of seeing what is in a shop and knowing what shouldn't be there. And she's also got a beautiful sense of finding the right staff, seeing in somebody's heart and intuiting what shouldn't be there too. So it's a formidable combination, and she's one of the reasons why things are going so well in Tokyo. We also have a great collaboration with an architecture firm called Schemata Architects. Joe Nagasaka is the principal. So far, he's done all three of the shops we have there. And it's also just a very pure expression using humble materials, not a lot of walnut and Carrara marble, but MDF and plywood and plate steel to create this environment that is welcoming, not too austere, not like some sort of prison, but it really helps focus on the experience of the coffee and the hospitality around the coffee.
Oh, I had a question along the same lines about your experience in Japan. I've been to Blue Bottle several in San Francisco, but I have not been to one in Tokyo. Mm. If I were to walk into one in Tokyo, would I have a different experience or the same experience? Would the coffee taste the same? Is that all intentional? You slightly mentioned that people were trying to advise you how Starbucks made some changes when they went to Japan, and I was curious about that too. So
yeah, hopefully the coffee tastes just the same. The espresso is extracted the same way here. They might have different single origins than we are here, so there might be a slightly different coffee menu. The sizes are exactly the same. The pastries in the case are the same. We do have a hood in our Aoyama shop, so we have beignets, which is really nice if you're out there. I do feel like our retail standards are very high in Tokyo. So, for me, it's like, this is like, what I want all the shops to be. If you go there, you think, oh, wow, this is the cleanest Blue Bottle I've ever been in. I just think we're achieving more in Tokyo than we are achieving here, and which is great because it gives us something to continue to aspire to. But I wouldn't call it different necessarily. Hopefully it would feel very similar, and some of the feedback I've gotten is that it in fact does.
So our thanks to Mr. James Freeman, founder and CEO of Blue Bottle Coffee, for his remarks today.
Thank you for having me.
We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you for coming.